Hi everyone, welcome to Psychedelic Science Conference. We are here to witness an historic event. We have, I think, 11,000 people, attendees, coming to learn more about psychedelic and their benefits and therapeutic use. We're here for the next 3 days intensely, speaking to many leaders in the space and bringing you so much more news and updates. So stay tuned. Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Psychedelic Conversations. Today with me, I have Daniel Galla, PhD, and you are the founder of HMNC Brain Health, which is a global precision psychiatry biopharma company pioneering the development of personalized therapies powered by predictive companion diagnostics, which is technology. I had to read that because there's quite a lot.
Yeah, I know. I would like to correct that I'm not the founder. The founder is Professor Florian Holzbauer, that's a famous German psychiatrist, and the other one is Carsten Maschmeyer, that's a German entrepreneur. And there's an interesting story how this company came to be. So this German entrepreneur, Carsten Maschmeyer, he had a fantastic exit. So he sold his company and became a billionaire overnight. But this really ripped him out of his work life, and he became depressed and even addicted to sleeping pills. And our other founder, who's a psychiatrist, helped him out of this. And because he's so grateful for that help, they now co-founded this company and we still have his support. So that's what the H and M stands for. H stands for Holzbauer, M for Maschmeyer, and then the NC for neurochemistry.
Brilliant. Thank you for clarifying that and sharing that. This is great. I'm always in awe how these companies come to be. And there's always a very human story behind it.
Absolutely.
I love that. And your role is?
My role is I'm an associate director for biomarkers at the company. But as we are a small startup, I'm not only looking for biomarkers. In fact, I'm leading a phase 2 clinical program where we want to explore the precision psychiatry approach.
Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so precision psychiatry has the idea, and this is based on the research we have seen, is that patients such as those with major depressive disorder, they are not one similar group, but they show a lot of heterogeneity within them. So what that means is that because we diagnose depression based on symptoms, okay, and you follow the DSM-5 rules in the US, and it might be that you have two patients diagnosed with major depressive disorder, but they have not a single symptom in common. So we know there are various factors that can contribute to depression. So that could be, for example, chronic inflammation, it could be wrong exercise, the diet has a big influence, right? Your relationship, your beliefs. So it's multifactorial, but they are all put together under the same label. You know, you are depressed. And then we try to treat all of these various things by giving one pill to all of them, right? This has been the model so far. And we believe that this needs to change because we are not happy with the outcomes of these treatments, these antidepressant treatments. There is new players on the horizon, especially psychedelic-assisted therapy, and I hope we can discuss this. But nevertheless, also for those, what we propose is match the right treatment, and may it be pharmacotherapy, may it be psychotherapy, or a combination of those with the patients with the right patients. So if someone has maybe more of an inflammatory cause to that depression, you know, try to specifically fight that. And our idea and what we stand for is the stress axis in the body. So this is where our founder's research has been focused the last 30 years at the Max Planck Institute of Psychiatry in Munich. He was the director of that, and he really focused on how the stress axis is implicated in psychiatric disorders. And there we've seen that in a subpopulation of the depressed patients, which is roughly 30% of them, the stress axis is not able to regulate itself. So quickly, what is the stress axis? This is the so-called HPA axis. It stands for the hypothalamus thalamus, pituitary, adrenal gland axis, because this is how our body releases cortisol. So if there's a stressor, and we have plenty of them, this leads to the release of cortisol, and it's very important for survival. You know, this stress axis allows us to flexibly adapt to challenging situations. But then cortisol should go back to the brain and shut its own production off and say, okay, that's it. We survived the stress, and now let's go on. And then in the subset of patients, this stress axis feedback is disturbed. So they will never come down from their stress levels. This is always overactive. And through a series of elegant research studies, we have found out that this is related with a molecule in the brain called vasopressin. So vasopressin is a neurohormone, and that together with its cousin CRH, corticotropin-releasing hormone, they both act on the pituitary gland to release ACTH, and this then releases cortisol from the adrenal glands. So that's enough of the science, but I just want to give the background. So we have this stress axis, and we believe we have a tool to identify those patients. And then we have a compound that specifically only modulates this vasopressinergic system. And that's the step forward we want to make by not going only with symptoms that are captured by questionnaires, but we are looking for a genetic signature that would predict if you have such a dysregulated stress axis.
Wow, I'm so impressed. That's something.
Yeah, I think this is the way many people in the field believe we need to go, because we see even with psychedelic assisted therapies, let's say, we still see an amount of patients not responding to the treatment, and it can be 20, 30, or 40%. Similarly with ketamine, where this is a fantastic therapy for treatment-resistant depression and possibly for many more indications. But there is this pool of patients that do not show a response, and that is clearly coming from the fact that the diagnosis is not objective. It's based on an interaction with the physician. And you cannot assume that one treatment really fits everyone.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, we have this popular saying in the therapy world, treatment resistant symptoms or mental health disorders. What you explained to me is like, it's almost like treatment resistant in psychedelic use as well. There are subgroup of people still cannot benefit from psychedelics, even if the container, the space, setting, intention, therapy is perfectly organized.
Yes.
There's still subgroup still not going to benefit from that.
So this is what I've seen from the clinical trials that have been performed with psilocybin-assisted therapy. I have been here on this conference talking to a lot of therapists because I'm really interested in how this works. And some therapists say they have never seen a non-response. So for them, everything worked. But this is then again maybe in an underground setting where it's not measured with these questionnaires that we usually have, and that the FDA would require, like the Montgomery-Åsberg Depression Rating Scale or the Hamilton Depression Rating Scale. So there you see in some patients an initial improvement in the acute phase and in the early days, but it is not a long-lasting effect. And I'm curious, and this is why I'm talking to a lot of therapists here to find out how does it look, because as you said, if there were really now treatment resistant also to the psychedelic assisted therapy, I can imagine that to be a very depressing finding for yourself.
Absolutely.
Right? Absolutely. Because you have been treatment resistant against the standard of care.
Absolutely.
And now you hear there's this magic bullet almost, right? The last hope for me, yeah. the power of the psychedelics. And then you also fail that. You know, that must be really depressing.
Absolutely.
Because and leaves you almost hopeless. You know, what else could
in
there
despair.
Then... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking to one therapist?
I was just talking to a therapist at lunch, yeah.
I can be very, very honest about my own experience. I've seen a lot of people getting really desperate and depressed because it's not working for them. So in my experience, I can tell you that they do exist. And like you said, it just reinforces the belief of there's nothing there for me out there that can ever help me. Yeah.
Yeah, that's tragic, right? So I'm considering to, you know, if it would be worth to have a test of some kind before you go into psychedelic assisted therapy, yeah, to see if it works. Because that would, first of all, prevent such an added suffering to these patients. And furthermore, it would open up capacity for therapists to work with others for which it would work. You see, because that is the limiting factor, as I see it, is the access to therapy, to therapists.
Yeah, I really love this conversation, to be honest. So from my understanding, because I'm a somatic therapist as well, so I get the nervous system activation and it's on survival, immobilization. And you talked about the axis and how it's kind of feeding the cortisol back and there's a loop. I have people in my community that actually their resting state is very high levels of cortisol. And of course their environment. So when I, from a holistic perspective, we look at put their life under microscope. So what is it that's continually feeding this dysregulation? It's always their relationship that they can't get out. So they feel like they're stuck. They've invested in relationships that's so tied in intricate ways they can't. It's a human thing, right? We all do. So they can't see any way out. And then businesses, they invested in businesses, now they can't leave or get out. Or children, having children with all kinds of challenges, right? Parents, siblings, like these are the kind of things that keep them at that really sort of hyper cortisol active state. So when you say to me, we've got the technology and the precision way of working with this type of people, how does that look in a practical way in their lives? How do they take this home now? So that would be my interest.
So we hope to develop a pharmacotherapy solution for that, which we currently do not foresee to be paired with psychotherapy, but it's always recommendable to have psychotherapy added to that. So the idea would be that these patients, when taking this vasopressin 1B antagonist that we develop, that this at least helps them to regulate the stress axis, and that allows them to then continue to work on their like psychotherapy, and to, because I think we agree that they need to make the necessary changes in the life. If you have the same environment and the same stimuli that cause this stress and you don't remove them or don't have new coping strategies for that, right, I think we agree that you will fall back. Even if you have a pharmacotherapeutic success, you will fall back. And maybe this is also seen with the ketamine assisted psychotherapy. We see that without the therapy, it will come back again, right? So if you pair it with therapy, you have longer lasting effects and need to repeat less often.
Yeah.
So otherwise, I think this is a very interesting topic, and the holistic view on the things is definitely interesting. Yeah, you need to look, as I said in the beginning, right? This is multifactorial. You have exercise, sleep, relationships, belief systems, and the stress axis is one of them, definitely.
And at the moment, the way the situation in the current reality that we all live in, I think most people live with hijacked nervous systems.
Yes.
Very difficult. So I'm guessing this specific development that you have, because is it ketamine? It's based ketamine, right?
So the other program that we have is a ketamine-based program, yes.
Tell me about that, because I was going to say, obviously, this work is brilliant, and I also love the idea of incorporating therapy. But then earlier we talked about, like, maybe, I don't know if you want to go there, like bringing in the technology, ChatGPT, very, exactly. Very popular right now.
Exactly.
How would that look like in our reality?
This is very open, right? And when we talk about AI and psychedelics, these are very, very vibrant and innovative fields these days. And throwing them together is probably in a synergistic way very interesting to explore. We don't know. What I jokingly suggested yesterday on stage is to have something like a shrink GPT, right? So it's it could be a large language model like ChatGPT that is specifically looking at psychiatric or psychologic support. So that could be either a tool, you know, to train therapists. So the training could be improved and scaled up because you, as I understand now, if you want to become a psychedelic assisted therapist, you need to undergo training, right?
Right.
So how many hours of training is that?
Years.
It's years.
Yes.
Years. So maybe by the help of these tools, it can be condensed down to less time, and that would allow, you know, more therapists to
be available.
So this is one way I could imagine. On the other hand, if we are more bold and believe a little bit more in the technology, at some point in the future, the entire guided session might be replaced or augmented by such a shrink GPT. So I'm not a big fan of this idea, and I talked with the people here on the conference, and they all confirm that this what the guide actually mostly provides during the active phase of the substance is just support, right? They are just there for you. There's some nurturing touch, and I think that is something that a shrink GPT is certainly not being able to deliver at this point. But we have also advances in robotics, yeah. And now it seems ridiculous, but if we zoom fast forward 20 years and the robots have features that we got used to, and you infuse that with an AI model that could help you, and just imagine the possibilities. I mean, this is crazy, like a shrink GPT or something like this, right? Which knows you because you chat with this every day. You know, if you have a real shrink, you see that psychiatrist maybe once a week or once every 2 weeks, but such a system might know you so good and so well that the guidance for a therapy might be much more tailored, much more specific, and by that robotics could somehow emulate this touch and presence that you would need. But that is far, far out in the future. I'm just playing with thoughts here. So yeah.
Yeah, I can see that it's going to go towards that direction. I guess especially the younger generation is probably going to be very open to this. Because the younger generation seems to be so involved and immersed in the technology, I guess they are excited about this. And I'm sure they're already having these conversations, right? But then in about 20 years' time, what about, like, if maybe we don't need guidance, we don't need ChatGPT shrink? Maybe there's going to be far more advanced technologies that people might... Like the Elon Musk's technology, right? The chip.
The Neuralink.
Right.
Yeah, so with Neuralink, in my PhD, I worked with animals in basic science, and their colleagues and I myself were using similar technology. So that there's called NeuroPixels. It's an electrode you stick into the brain. That is definitely an interesting technology, but to be honest, I think until this is the science fiction.
Yeah.
I mean, until we're there where the vision has been set out, I think that will still take a long time. What we will see, I think, in the next 10 years is definitely implants that will help disabled people in some way to read the commands that their motor cortex would do. I think this is in reach, and this is very realistic and already done. People can move cursors on a screen just with their thoughts. I mean, this is happening. So this technology will progress together with AI, together with robotics, together with biotechnology itself, together with material science. So it's getting ever harder and harder to predict where this goes. And this is what Ray Kurzweil has already described many decades ago with this exponential progression in technology. So it's you know, putting any duration on anything is getting harder and harder.
Does it worry you?
No, it does not worry me immediately because I'm rather pro technology. But maybe that's why I'm still young, right? And the more you think about ethics and the impact on society, and we need to have this discussion and we need to have it early. I'm the driving innovative force. This is what I see myself. But I'm happy to be, you know, to get resistance from ethical considerations from society.
Yeah, for sure. More conversations needs to be having. Talk to me about the ketamine program.
Yeah, so we know that ketamine is a fantastic opportunity to have treatment-resistant patients now with something that's fast-acting, long-lasting. But what we see is that the currently approved ketamine treatment is Spravato, that's intranasal esketamine. And it has still some side effects that make it necessary for the patient to stay in the clinic for 2 hours. And not many psychiatrists have the infrastructure to kind of trip-sit someone for 2 hours. And that's why also the Spravato is not picked up very rapidly. It's also very costly medication. And then you have the IV clinics, but they are also very expensive and not really affordable for yeah. most people. And there we've seen the need to now provide a solution for a tablet that people can take at home and will not experience any dissociative side effects. So that's the goal. And we have developed the tablet in such a way that the ketamine is very, very, very slowly released into the bloodstream, right, so that it does not even reach concentrations that will get you high. The ketamine is on the way through the body already metabolized to what's called hydroxynorketamine, or briefly HNK. And there has been a lot of research around HNK because it's speculated to be a main factor for driving the antidepressant response. This is still not fully settled. People are still researching on it. And just recently, there was a paper coming out about a new target, like the tyrosine receptor kinase B, TRK B receptor, that the psychedelics like LSD, psilocybin, and ketamine, but more so HNK, binds to this TRK B, and that this could lead to the antidepressant efficacy. So it's not clear how exactly it works, and that's why we use a racemic mixture of ketamine, because we know we have the strongest evidence that a racemic mixture works. And with that slow release, we get rid of the dissociative side effects. And to fully confirm this, we have run a phase 2 clinical trial. We have completed that now and are waiting for the data to be finally sent over to us, which will happen in 2 weeks. And then we hope to present this at the ACNP conference later this year.
All sounds wonderful and exciting for you. So why ketamine? Why is the choice of ketamine? Is it easier to, you know, bring it to the people? Why ketamine is easier to, you know, be the one to chosen psychedelic substance?
Yeah, so we chose ketamine because it has the most research and evidence to it that it works. Of course, there is evidence with esketamine. They got the approval that it works, but we don't have the access to that intellectual property to that. But we invented the slow release formulation. So this was the path. We recognized and appreciate the effects of racemic ketamine, because it's not clear if you need to meet enantiomer selective. And that is our vision, to provide this medicine more widely to the people so they can take it at home. Also for people who are maybe not seeking the dissociative experience.
Yes. Yeah. And coming from Germany, like the work that you're undertaking, does it kind of have ties within the culture and the way you guys see things in the psychedelic space? Like, what did you observe when you're spending time here looking at this global community coming together? And the reason I'm asking, when I work with people from Europe, like Germany, Netherlands, they are very different in the way they see psychedelic substances. Like, do you agree, or is it my own observation?
No, I think I agree. In Central Europe, I think people are rather skeptic, but I think that's the majority views. People are are afraid of this because it's new. It is somehow, you know, it came with the hippie counterculture. It's associated with this. Still this drug-taking rave techno scene, but we do see in Germany and Europe initiatives to pop up. There's the Mind Foundation at the Charité in Berlin. Research is being done with this at the Central Institute of Mental Health in Mannheim. Things are being done, so we start seeing that research is picking up, and they do get the research licenses to do that. But the societal movement that is clearly noticeable here is, you know, we are far away from this. And also given the German culture, I really cannot foresee this to be there anytime soon.
Yeah.
So, but we are. I think what Germany is doing well is, and Europe in general, if a medicine is working and they have evidence and it's evidence based, then I think there will be a good path forward to the medicalization of the substances. But for the recreational and personal growth use, I don't see any true option in the next 10 years, to be honest.
Yeah, this is what I wanted to hear from you, because yes, highly skeptical, and they're very kind of research based. It has to be proven, and it has to be kind of backed up with a lot of data, right?
Exactly.
So, which is not a bad thing.
No, right? And I think that's why MAPS chose this way of medicalizing MDMA therapy with veterans, right? It definitely has its merits, because how could you argue against a phase 3 study?
Right.
You just needed $100 million to get it up and running, and they achieved this, and I have biggest respect for that.
Yeah, for sure. And there are so many people looking for different ways of working with the medicines or the substances, psychedelic substances. So I get that. So, Daniel, what are your future projects? Where will you be? Where do you see this company moving forward as a representative?
Yeah, I hope that we as HMNC Brain Health can pioneer precision psychiatry and show that it's possible, that we can select patients and match them with the right treatment, and that this is more efficacious than just treating all with one treatment. And I hope this really spawns a new field of precision psychiatry. There are already a few companies seeking the same, and I hope that we all can transform the way how we treat major depressive disorder. But we will not stop there. We are then looking for other diseases that are naturally correlated with the dysregulated stress axis.
Amazing. It feels like an ever-evolving, expanding, growing thing, right? It's just, we're just at the precipice of a beginning of something huge. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much. So where can our listeners find you, connect with you, look at your papers and understand more of what you're doing? I'm sure a lot of our European friends will appreciate you a lot. And also results of your phase 2 trial is in 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks, we get the results, so I'm not sure when we are able to share this with the public. But there, keep an eye out for the ketamine KET-0102 study results. That will be very interesting. The other study that I'm heading has just recruited the first patient, and that is an 8-country study in Europe with 324 patients. So we are also looking forward to get the study up and running. Yeah, people can find me on LinkedIn and Twitter handle @Daniel_Gerlach.
Brilliant. We'll have all your links and everything in the show notes. And also would love to follow up and have you back very soon.
Yeah,
and you can talk about the research papers that, by then, if it's not published or published, either way.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure having you here with us and learning about the work you're doing. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks everyone for joining us. Hope you guys enjoyed this conversation. So it is like AI meets psychedelics, I guess. And it's a very interesting and a powerful work. Everyone's doing a very interesting thing. Every person I met in the conference has just been insane. Stay tuned, and I'll see you guys on the next one. Bye for now.